From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Well, more than a week has passed since Fox News Channel and CNN broke the story of the year, the Supreme Court's historic decision on Obamacare.
We have breaking news here on the Fox News Channel. The individual mandate has been ruled unconstitutional.
So it appears as if the Supreme Court justices have struck down the individual mandate.
Oops. Within 2 minutes, more deliberate outlets were saying Obamacare was, in fact, upheld. But here at OTM, we refuse to rush to judgment. We check and double check. And also, we aired a rerun last week, so we had plenty of time to review the Supreme Court misreporting episode every which way. And we are finally prepared to weigh in. Fox and CNN, what a bunch of nincompoops. By failing to read much past the first page of Chief Justice John Roberts' 59-page decision before rushing onto the air, both cable channels managed to get the story not just wrong, but 180 degrees wrong. They called heads, it was tails. But then, what else is new? Lately, the rush to be first has led to all sorts of embarrassing screw-ups. At CNN...
CNN has now confirmed that at least 20 bodies have been found in a home.
At CNN again.
The state-run Middle East news agency in Cairo is now reporting that Hosni Mubarak, the former president of Egypt, in the words of MENA, the Middle East news agency, is, quote, clinically dead.
And at NPR, which, amid the chaos of an Arizona shooting spree, reported the death of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords.
NPR News apologizes to the family of Representative Giffords and to you, our listeners. We deeply regret our error.
The fullness of time allows me to update the record. Gabby Giffords survived. There was no massacre. Mubarak isn't dead. The topics of these misreported stories were literally matters of life and death, but for the news organizations, what exactly are the stakes for beating the competition? Not for scooping the competition, with a big exclusive resulting from journalistic enterprise, but just being the first to break breaking news. Going back to the hoariest days of wire service competition, that's been called a beat.
So much depended on us being both first and right with stories.
Jerry Schwartz is news features editor for the AP, where he has worked for decades. He has vivid memories of the old teletype machines, which would clatter and ring with alerts of an AP beat over rival UPI on a dead pope, a baby pulled from a well, or a presidential victory.
I remember them, and I remember the scars when the messages didn't come and because UPI beat us. And that happened. We don't admit it very often, but it did happen. It was the heartbeat of our lives.
Schwartz began his career in the late 70s, which was not the 1930s, but technologically not far removed. Nor had the culture and the hardware much changed even in 1987, when he was dispatched to cover the verdict in the case against Bernhard Goetz, New York's so-called subway vigilante.
When you went on a big story, the first thing you did was check out where the payphone was. And if you were especially devious, you would not only find where the payphone was, some of my colleagues, I was not among them, disable the phone in such a way so that you were the only one who could use it.
And sounds like something out of the front page.
Well, yeah, but you know, that's exactly what it was. You would run to the phone and you dictate the news.
Sweetheart, get me rewrite.
Exactly. But the Bernhard Goetz case came at that weird moment when cell phones were coming into vogue. And we had what I believe was one of the AP's first cell phones.
Must have been the size of a loaf of
bread. It was the size of a small suitcase. It was this huge thing that we lugged around. We were not allowed to bring it into the courtroom. And then the verdict came down, and we raced out and prayed desperately that we'd be able to make a connection with it. And in fact, we did. And it was the first time I in my entire life had used a cell phone.
Yeah, he beat UPI. And what did news consumers get out of that? Not one blessed thing. Newspaper readers got their papers when they got them, not when the AP moved the story, and broadcast audiences heard the news on whatever station they happened to be tuned into, which means they were oblivious to any time lag on a UPI-served station they weren't tuned into. Firstness was then, and remains today a journalistic compulsion of vanishingly little consequence. Schwartz believes there's a cumulative benefit to beating the competition, but neither he nor anyone else can prove that. What he knows for certain is the competitiveness in his bones.
For people who are in news, that is one of the reasons that they're in news, because they like that battle, that race to get the news out.
Don't discount journalist pride.
Paul Fahrey covered the Supreme Court misreporting fiasco for the Washington Post.
Telling people something they didn't know before the other guy tells them the same thing is a point of how we operate.
Fahrey, too, insists that the public somehow absorbs the competitive push and pull among news organizations, but concedes the difference between a clear-cut scoop and a fractional breaking news beat, such as the one CNN and Fox sought last week before making utter fools of themselves.
Everybody had the news about the Supreme Court. No one was getting an advance on that. It was just a typing contest. Who could type it out fast enough?
Yet Jerry Schwartz predicts not a lesser emphasis on news beats, but in a Twitter world, a greater one, measured not in hours or minutes.
If it's down to seconds now, it'll be down to milliseconds eventually.
And why? Because in a digital world, page views rule, and theoretically, speed provides an edge on page views. Ergo, the first, even with the worst, even with Dewey beats Truman, wins the traffic, and with it, pots full of money. Which would mean the digital world has finally monetized and justified journalism's least justifiable impulse. But wait, just to be on the safe side, we ran that theory by Clark Fredrickson of the digital research firm eMarketer. We asked him if, having analyzed the data, crunched the numbers, evaluated user behavior, and the fortunes of 1,000 digital enterprises, he can find any correlation between being first and being successful.
The short answer is no.
Well, you heard it here first. It was a dark and stormy night. Last Friday, a thunderstorm in Virginia temporarily crippled part of Amazon's cloud computing service. After a series of backups failed, such popular sites as Netflix, Pinterest, and Instagram were, for several hours, knocked off the internet. What were they doing on Amazon's cloud in the first place? They lease server capacity there because it's less expensive and more efficient than building out their own. But the outage is a reminder that our online access remains vulnerable, even in the pillowy remoteness of the cloud. Nicholas Carr is the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Let's say I'm the average person. How much of what I do on the internet and in my just ordinary computer applications takes place on the cloud?
A whole lot of it. Over the last 5 or 10 years, we've really gone from a model of personal computing where everything pretty much was stored on our hard drive to a model of personal computing where most things we do are done in the cloud, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or your online banking or your email accounts. In a similar way, big companies use services like Amazon Web Services to run their own applications for their business or to run their websites or to do whatever they would traditionally do with their own servers and their own equipment. It's a utility system, in essence, for computing.
Now, we know Amazon as a book retailer and, in fact, as an everything retailer. How is it that Amazon has become cloud to the world?
Well, if you think about it, Amazon, in order to run its retailing operation, had to build an enormous computer system. And as we know from retailing, demand goes up and down. You know, around Christmas, you have to have tons of capacity for your shoppers. And then in February, it drops off. And so what Amazon realized a number of years ago is it had all this extra capacity in its own system. And it's invested a fairly huge amount, I think it's fair to say, in building out data centers to rent out cloud computing capacity.
I just want to observe that in last weekend's outage, what we lost was Netflix streaming, which is tragic, but no lives were lost, and Pinterest and Instagram. You know, the world still spun on its axis. What else resides in the cloud that really might have been catastrophic had a similar series of events taken place.
Pretty much everything, all commerce these days, lots of government services, lots of services in general, take place online. And therefore, they're vulnerable to a big network failure. Now, I have to say that's independent from cloud computing, because cloud computing is part of it, but a lot of big companies, a lot of big financial institutions, the government run their own data centers, and those data centers are vulnerable too. So the risk doesn't come from just cloud computing. It comes from the fact that more and more important services that we do, and in fact, almost the entire economy, runs through the exchanges of data on networks. So there could be a catastrophic occurrence that would take that down, and basically the economy would grind to a halt.
I can't help but think about not last week's outages, but the great blackout of 1965, which shut down New York and New England and into Canada. As it's constructed today, does the data storage utility pose that kind of risk?
Probably not the same level of risk, because unlike the electric grid, which is run regionally, there's no reason that a data center, for instance, in California couldn't take over the load for one on the East Coast. But what happened to Amazon is a warning, because what should happen in these cases is that backup power supply, which all these data centers have, should kick in immediately. That didn't happen here. For some reason, the backups didn't work. So here we see in a kind of microcosm how these unexpected chains of events can actually happen, set off by a massive thunderstorm. Anytime you get so many companies and so many people sharing the same equipment, if that equipment fails, then lots of people are affected.
Nick, as always, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Nicholas Carr is the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. Coming up, the awesome clickability of BuzzFeed. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On October 1st, 2011, an Occupy Wall Street march ended on the roadway of the Brooklyn Bridge with hundreds of protesters blocked on both sides by police and eventually arrested. Malcolm Harris was one of those protesters, later charged with disorderly conduct. In his defense, Harris claims that the New York police corralled him onto the roadway. But the prosecution alleges that he not only blocked the road of his own volition, he planned as much well before the fact. To prove its contention of premeditation, the prosecution subpoenaed from Twitter the records of 3 months' worth of tweets Harris had since deleted. Harris, and eventually Twitter itself, sought to quash that subpoena on First and Fourth Amendment grounds. But on Monday, Manhattan Judge Matthew Chirino ordered Twitter to comply with the subpoena. In his decision, Chirino wrote, "If you post a tweet, just like if you scream it out the window, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy." So why would Harris and Twitter fight to protect tweets that were public anyway? First of all, according to Twitter, the Harris subpoena was just one of 679 U.S. law enforcement requests for Twitter information this year. And according to American Civil Liberties Union lawyer Aidan Fine, the information subpoenaed was far more than just Harris's tweets.
A lot of the information that they've requested here, the IP addresses, the location information, is not publicly available. And so that's the key thing to focus on here, which the judge did not focus on. Only Twitter and Mr. Harris had that information. And so before the government can get private, non-public information like that, they do need to get a warrant.
As I understand it, a couple centuries of jurisprudence have found that the Fourth Amendment, protecting citizens from unreasonable search and seizure, does not protect you against information provided by third parties. Twitter, in this case, is a third party.
The fact that the government is seeking the information from a third party doesn't mean that the individual whose constitutional rights are at stake doesn't have the right to go to court to seek to protect his constitutional rights. The court here held that Mr. Harris doesn't even have the right to come to court and to make his arguments that his constitutional rights are at stake.
He had no standing in the case, they say.
And the court's rationale is that Twitter owns the information being requested, not Mr. Harris. But who owns the information is not relevant to whether Mr. Harris has standing. And the Supreme Court and numerous courts around the country have made clear that individuals whose constitutional rights are implicated by requests to third parties have standing to go into court to challenge those government requests. Otherwise, their constitutional rights will simply be illusory.
Yeah. Twitter, to its credit, went to court to fight the subpoena. What was its argument in its desire not to turn this information over to the New York City District Attorney?
The DA issued this subpoena to Twitter. They told Twitter, keep this secret. Twitter's company policy is to notify their users whenever they're legally permitted to do so. Even though the DA here told Twitter to keep this secret and not to notify anyone, Twitter knew that that wasn't enforceable. And Twitter talked to the DA and convinced the DA to let them notify Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris then filed his own motion to quash the subpoena. The court denied that motion to quash by Mr. Harris. The court erroneously ruled that their users don't have the right to even go to court to protect their constitutional rights. And from Twitter's perspective, you know, that can't be right, because otherwise Twitter is going to be forced to have to go to court to defend every one of their users whose information is subject to one of these government requests.
If we can agree that it's alarming that a court would rule that a citizen has no standing to try to keep a police agency from gathering evidence for his own prosecution, there's also the fact that this was not the Supreme Court. How frightened should we be that this ruling was handed down, and what chances does it have, in your experience as a civil liberties lawyer, to make it to a next round of jurisprudence?
We should all be very frightened that the government is becoming increasingly aggressive in seeking out all this information about what individuals are doing on the internet. And this is not, unfortunately, an isolated incident. And so a decision like this one, while it's one of the first decisions that are out there on this issue, is very important, not because it's going to bind other courts, but because other courts that consider this issue are going to look to see what this New York criminal court judge has done.
Aidan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Aidan Fine is a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. It used to be that winning online meant winning in search. If you were, say, the Huffington Post, your job was to get to the top of Google's search rankings for any given term in order to capture web traffic, and with it, ad views and money. Now, people are trying to make money online by getting you to share stories on sites like Facebook. The trick is to engineer perfectly addictive, emotional content, the kind of stories that people feel hypnotically compelled to read and share. One of the stars of this new method is the website BuzzFeed, created by Jonah Peretti, one of HuffPo's founders. The site is a compendium of internet clickbait. A picture of an 800-pound shark, Mitt Romney, looking goofy on a jet ski, and 11 ways to get inspired right now. The content may be trivial, but the money is anything but. The site raised its third round of funding this year, $15.5 million, much of which it's using to hire actual journalists, like former Politico writer Ben Smith, to complement the fun stuff. Slate tech writer Farhad Manju is an avowed BuzzFeed fan, and he decided to sleuth out how exactly BuzzFeed employees churn out such delicious offerings. Well, here's a hint. They don't necessarily come up with the ideas themselves.
I looked through many of BuzzFeed's posts for a couple weeks, and I found that on many of their popular ones, they weren't very transparent about sort of where they got their pictures and where they got their ideas. But if you did a bunch of searching around the internet on Google, and especially on a site called Reddit, which is a site where lots of people discuss funny things online, if you searched in those places, you could find kind of the seeds of BuzzFeed's inspiration. In some cases, I found entire galleries that BuzzFeed seemed to have spotted and then made their own version of it and then didn't credit the originator. And in other cases, they weren't exactly copying other people, but they were finding stuff on Reddit and not giving Reddit very much credit.
No credit for Reddit. Let's talk briefly about Reddit. I think we need to understand what this is all about. It's just a place where civilians go and they say, OMG, look what I found. Isn't this hilarious, right?
Yeah, it's become, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, this really powerful online discussion site. And they have become, in some ways, the originator of many of the internet's memes and jokes. And if things weren't started at Reddit, they often kind of propel memes to a new level.
So if you're a meme hunter at BuzzFeed, it's kind of like your meme superstore, right? So when they find something that's hilarious or intriguing or just cool, do they just link to it? Do they republish it in its entirety? Or do they repackage it maybe with more examples of whatever the phenomenon is that wound up on Reddit in the first place?
Let me tell you the story of one post that I think kind of encapsulates what BuzzFeed does, both good and bad. So they had a post a couple weeks ago called 21 Pictures That Will Restore Your Faith in Humanity. And this was a huge blockbuster. They attracted more than 7 million views for it. By now, it's probably much more than that even. And these basically was pictures of people doing wonderful things in the world, really inspirational, saving animals from disaster, people kind of being unexpectedly kind to others. And so I tried to figure out where they got the idea for this. So I did some searching and I found a few sources. So one, another meme site called Ned Hardy had, over the course of the last year, posted two different galleries about restoring your faith in humanity. And many of the photos that were in BuzzFeed's post first appeared there at Ned Hardy. But Ned Hardy, you know, didn't create these photos. They had found those photos elsewhere. So if you search back to the original source of these photos, it turns out a lot of them appeared on Reddit first. And if you basically just go to Reddit and you search for phrases like faith in humanity or, you know, make you feel better about the world or things related to that, you can find all of these photos that appeared, you know, in these galleries. BuzzFeed in its post doesn't credit Ned Hardy for, you know, coming up with galleries first. And it links to the sources of some of the images, but it links to them in a way that doesn't suggest that it found them on Reddit. It's a kind of a technical thing that shows just the photo that they found, but it doesn't give back credit to Reddit in any way.
Now, partly because I'm a very thoughtful commentator, and partly because I'm a little bit clairvoyant, and partly because I spoke to him actually before I spoke to you, I know that Jonah Peretti, who is the co-founder of BuzzFeed, will say, but this is just all part of internet culture. It's all about sharing and mashing up and improving and following the meme. Isn't this just kind of grooving on the meme?
Yeah, just to sort of further support his point, when I talked to people at Reddit, they didn't care about this. They thought it was part of internet culture. And when you see a BuzzFeed post that is inspired by Reddit, that doesn't credit Reddit, that gets really popular, it ends up back on Reddit and people there discuss it and are appreciative of it. So it seems like individual people who are on that site don't care either. I think, though, there are a couple issues. So this was okay, I think, back when BuzzFeed was trying to just be this weird, quirky meme sharing site, which was what it was about a year ago. Over the last year, though, it's trying to become something different. So it's hired a number of high-profile journalists Ben Smith from Politico and a bunch of others, and created various sections that try to cover the news, political news, tech news, with reporters. So I think in one sense, it muddies what BuzzFeed does to have some parts of it that are journalistic and other parts that kind of live by the sharing code of the web.
You know, dude, I have given you every opportunity to summon outrage. There's no outrage. What exactly have you summoned in your big BuzzFeed scoop?
I mean, it's not outrage like you hear a journalist ripped off another journalist. It's not like plagiarism.
No, it's not that. No, it's not plagiarism.
Yeah, right. It's not plagiarism. It's just sort of behaving badly on the internet and, you know, making a lot of money from it. You know, I think I'm more upset as kind of a regular BuzzFeed reader who kind of thought there was some magic to it.
So you're not outraged. You're just upset because you just found out there's no fairy dust.
Yeah. In the story, I say it's like seeing the wizard behind the curtain. Like, it's kind of dispiriting. Like, I really thought there was some magic here, that they were figuring out, you know, exactly what would delight people online. But they were just looking for it. I mean, they were just doing better searches.
Farhad, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. BuzzFeed's founder, Jonah Peretti, in response to Manju, says, well, they're not stealing anything.
The post under discussion in that Slate piece was a post about faith in humanity, which he suggested we stole the idea of faith from humanity from a particular blogger or from Reddit. And the truth is that all across the web, there's a trope talking about when something gives you faith in humanity.
It's become genericized, in a sense.
It's become genericized, and it's really difficult to know who created, or what group of people often created, a particular image or a particular story, because these images show up everywhere across all of these different user-generated platforms. Now, if you see a particular image and you go search Reddit, you'll find that image there. You'll also find it if you search Pinterest. You'll also find it if you were able to search 4chan. You'll also find it on Tumblr. And so it's very difficult to know, where did the image start and how did it spread and who created it? A lot of times, anonymous groups of very creative people all contribute to making something great in web culture.
If you were to read a book, hypothetically, and the first line were, say, just to pluck something out of the ether, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And your lead the next day goes, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and it was also kind of in the middle. Do you credit this Charles Dickens guy who started the ball rolling?
Yeah, you should definitely credit.
So he's saying that you don't do that well enough, that within your lists, there are items that are clearly plucked from Reddit or other sources.
Well,
that you can, at a minimum, give a shout out, even though you've buffed it up, shined it, gotten it ready for sale, you know, like a used car dealer, that it's still somebody else's contrivance.
We have a team of very creative people who meet and brainstorm and talk about what kinds of things could they make to delight people, what kind of content can they create that people will want to share. And those people are also reading everything that is created across the social web, on Tumblr, on Reddit, on Twitter, on Facebook, and they have a tremendous sense of what resonates, what people like, what's already been created, and how to build on top of that. And so I think, you know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. We all are inspired by other people. I think the culture of the web progresses when people see other people's work and are inspired by it and strive to make it better and build on top of it. And that's really how all of this stuff is built.
Are you standing on the shoulders of giants or on the shoulders of a billion midgets?
We're standing on the shoulders, in some cases, of pimply 13-year-olds who have a lot of time on their hands and are very clever and very creative and make some wondrous things on the internet. But the team that we have at BuzzFeed isn't pimply 13-year-olds, and they often are able to add a lot to that content and make it into something better.
Added value.
Yes, always.
Buffing up and preparing for sale.
I mean, one of our credos is always add value, always build on things, always make things better, and then always think about the user and why does someone think something's worth sharing with all their friends. It's something pretty amazing to say, I'm going to take this and share it with all my friends. That's a high bar. I think when you look at the history of the web, you see earlier stages of the web where people just said, I want to get clicks or slideshow views in the portal era of the web. And in the search area of the web, people just crammed keywords in, and you'd see people focused on making something for Google's robot. Now we all have to make content for real humans sharing with other real humans, and that means we really need to do great work and we need to make things that touch people emotionally and inspire people to pass something on to a friend.
There's this fantastic lawyer joke, the punchline of which is there's just some things even a rat won't do. Are there some things that even an aggregator won't do? What are the red lines?
One of the biggest challenges we have is BuzzFeed users who aren't on our editorial team, who will go to the front of Reddit and take something that was already on the front page of Reddit. And we actually don't post stuff like that onto the front page of BuzzFeed because it doesn't add any value. So we have a team that is looking at lots of posts on many different web culture sites and thinking about how to make something that's better than the sum of its parts. That's really sort of the key to it. We also see that a lot of traditional media sites and Web 1.0 sites have trouble when they cover web culture, particularly when they cover sites like 4chan and Reddit and Tumblr and Pinterest, in understanding what the culture is and what the language is and which things are novel and which things are just in the air and genericized. And that creates a lot of confusion when trying to understand what does a particular BuzzFeed post mean.
Are you calling me old?
I'm not calling you old.
All right, Jonah. I think we've played to a draw. Listen, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jonah Peretti is a founder of BuzzFeed, and before that, the Huffington Post. Coming up, the irresistibility of TV's most famous pitchman. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As anyone of a certain age is well aware, a Ginsu knife can cut through a penny or a tin can. For these vivid memories, we can thank Barry Bescher, the father of the Ginsu knife.
The Ginsu can cut a slice of bread so thin you can almost see through it. It cuts meat better than an electric knife and goes through frozen food as though it were melted butter.
Bescher died recently, but in the pantheon of Schlockmeisters, he is an immortal. A pioneer of direct response TV advertising, he not only discovered a way to take kitchen knives manufactured in Ohio and make them seem like exotic miracles, he honed the middle-of-the-night Channel 57 sales techniques to a fine edge. Ginsu, according to Bescher's New York Times obit, has no meaning in Japanese, but just sounded good. And so did the magic words, but wait, there's more. The gimmickry, the impressive coinage snipping demonstrations, and the seemingly endless bonus add-ons enriched Bescher and his partners, but also spawned an industry. A while back, erstwhile OTM producer Mike Volo dove into the world of television pitchmen. In memory of Barry Bescher, we replay it for you now.
Growing up in northern New Jersey in the 1970s and 80s, I would make regular trips down to Atlantic City with my family when school was out. There are certain sounds that stick out in my memory from those summers on the boardwalk. The ocean, of course. Seagulls screeching overhead just outside the Planters peanut store. The arcade. Oh yeah. And this guy.
There's no pumps, there's no motors, there's no batteries. It works direct from a bucket. Wash your car, your boat, your camper, your trailer.
That's Billy Mays pitching the amazing Washmatic, a portable cleaning system. If you weren't a professional pitchman, you might call it a 10-foot hose, a simple siphon with a one-way valve. It helps you save water.
One bucket to wash, one bucket to rinse.
Mays would set up on the boardwalk with a Washmatic and a minivan door and pitch that product all day. It earned him the nickname Bucket Billy. May says he learned from some of the best pitchmen we'll never know, guys selling everything from fishing gear to facial cream, and he counts himself among the last of the old mold. He even uses the jargon of the hard sell during conversation. You don't gather a crowd, you bally one. And it's not a crowd, it's a tip. Like a lot of pitchmen, Mays gets something close to reverential when he talks about what those in the industry call the turn.
All this so important turn. When you have that perfect pitch going, you better ask for the money. You better turn them right there because they're ready. They're ready to pull out the $20 right then and there. They already got it waving in the air. Sometimes that turn didn't always happen so quick. You had to go clap and bring them out of it. You're number one. You're number two. One thing you didn't want to happen, the front of your tip, break up and leave. You know, if you leave now, I'll never talk to you. Don't you dare do that right now. You kind of just force them to stay.
Mays pitched the Washmatic on the boardwalk, on the pier, and at state fairs for more than 10 years. It was in 1993 at the Pittsburgh Home and Garden Show that he met Max Apple, an amateur inventor who developed a citrus cleaner in his garage in Colorado. A few years later, Apple hired Mays to pitch the product, Orange Glow Wood Cleaner and Polish, on TV.
Made with pure orange oil. It cleans, polishes, and protects all the
Mays sold 6,000 bottles the first day, and then Apple expanded his business, with Mays again as the pitch man, to include something he called OxyClean.
It's powered by the air you breathe, activated by the water that you and I drink. In your laundry, the power of bleach, but it's safe. Watch this.
And ever since, late at night, early in the morning, whenever TV channels have cheap airtime to sell, Billy Mays has been coming into our homes.
Hi, Billy Mays here for Mighty Putty. Hi, Billy Mays here for the Big City Slider Station.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Steam Buddy.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Jupiter Jack.
Hi, Billy Mays back again with the Awesome Auger.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the Toll Bandit.
Hi, Billy Mays here for the world's greatest insole, Impact Gel.
Why am I smashing my hand with this hammer? To show you the amazing protection you get from Impact Gel.
That last product, Impact Gel, in case you couldn't hear him, is featured in the first episode of Mays' new reality show on the Discovery Channel called Pitchmen, Billy Mays.
You know, if you ask me what I am right now, I am a pitchman. I only know how to do one thing, sell products. It was taboo at certain times during my career where we would call ourselves professional demonstrators. Now, I'm proud to say I, Billy Mays, am a pitchman. That's what I am.
I think it's a term that historically rises and falls.
Glenn Hinson is a folklorist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says that during the old medicine shows of the late 19th century, a pitchman would prefer to call himself a talker and to call his pitch a lecture.
The idea of the lecture was to somehow wrap the rhetoric of the remarkable in the framing of the familiar. You wanted to invite your audience, the tip, to think differently about what they needed in their lives so that the audience would reach into their pockets, pull out that dollar bill for that bottle of tonic, and make the purchase.
I'm going to paint a word picture that the smallest boy or girl in the audience can understand. Those of you that keep house, you have sitting at your back door what we call a slop bucket or a garbage can.
One medicine show doctor, Dr. Fred Bloodgood, he used to say that the credo of many of the med show talkers was never use one word when four would suffice.
I've been putting that same food into my stomach, not for a day, not for a week, a month, or a year, but for 5 years, for 10 years, and I've never cleaned it out.
The first nail in the coffin of the old med shows was the Federal Food and Drugs Act of 1906. Its stated purpose was to prevent, quote, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of adulterated or misbranded or poisonous or deleterious foods, drugs, medicines, and liquors.
Something that would pass a tapeworm, head and all.
That put the medicine show on notice, and it eventually died out. Glenn Hinson.
In the history of medicine shows, if you look at those performers who went on from there, performers would move into vaudeville. They would move more particularly into places like the Grand Ole Opry. And in the Grand Ole Opry, where you have this idea of a radio show that combined pitches with entertainment, with the advent of television, it was a very simple move to make.
In the late 1940s, a guy named Nat Morris was hiring people, mostly his own family, to pitch products on the boardwalks of New Jersey. Nat Morris was the head of an extended family dynasty of pitchmen. In-laws, cousins, nephews. His own son, Arnold, was something of a pitching prodigy. You know that gimmick where some guy cuts through metal to demonstrate just how sharp the knife is? Arnold invented that 60 years ago.
This could be a chicken bone. It could be a ham bone, frozen food. This is steel against steel. Take a look at this. Something has to give. You see those filings over here? Now, there's only one way to find out if that knife is still razor sharp. You go back to the same tomato today, tonight, tomorrow, next week, next year, for the rest of your life, you never, ever have to sharpen a knife.
Between the years 1948 and 1954, the number of American households owning TV sets shot from less than 1% to more than 55%. It was during that time that the Morrises took the pitches they perfected on the boardwalks and filmed them as commercials. Modern-day medicine show talkers beamed right into our homes. They even shot half-hour spots, what we would now call infomercials, for the old Dumont network. They were disguised as cooking shows, but the whole point was to sell a Morris family product called the Roto-Broil, a rotisserie.
Hi, this is Lester Morris, the Roto-Magician, and here's our menu for today. Smorgasbord, Swedish meatballs, Sill salad, and Scandifus casserole.
Remember I said extended family dynasty? The Morrises were related to the Popeels, who struck gold in the 1960s with a whole line of kitchen gadgets, the Veg-O-Matic, Dial-O-Matic, even a Whip-O-Matic, pushing the infomercial pitch so deep into our pop cultural psyche that Dan Aykroyd spoofed it on Saturday Night Live in 1976.
How many times has this happened to you? You have a bass. You're trying to find an exciting new way to prepare it for dinner. You could scale the bass, remove the bass's tail, head and bones, and serve the fish as you would any other fish dinner. But why bother now that you can use Robco's amazing new kitchen tool, the Super Bass-O-Matic 76?
Yes, if anyone could sell Aykroyd's Bass-O-Matic,
the tool that lets you use the whole bass,
surely it would be Ron Popeil. Of the entire clan of Morrises and Popeils, some of the best salesmen America has ever seen, it is Ron who has been the most successful. It is Ron who has elevated the infomercial to its grand synthesis of theater and commerce. It is Ron who best put to practice the old pitchman's axiom. It's not what you sell, it's how you tell them the price.
You know you're not going to spend $400 for it, not $375 or $350, not $325 or even $300, not $275 or $250, not $225 or even $200 like you all may be thinking, not $190 or even $180. All you spend for this fabulous machine, an over $400 value, all you spend is just four easy monthly payments of $39.95.
They never tell you what the full price is because psychologists have done research on this and found that breaking things into smaller payments fools the human mind into thinking that it's really not the same thing.
Remy Stern is the author of But Wait, There's More, a book about the infomercial industry. He says another pitchman's ploy is to push the idea that time is running out, which he could do pretty convincingly on the boardwalk.
Usually he has more, probably in his truck about a block away. But the boxes that you'll see standing right next to him, there'll be a limited number, and he'll use that to his advantage to suggest that if you don't act now, you're not going to get this fantastic offer, which has since migrated to television, that same sense of creating this false scarcity.
False scarcity, though, is not as believable on TV. To reinforce the idea, then, an infomercial might use a counter to tick down the time. Sometimes there's a counter running up, tallying the number of items sold. This communicates what psychologists call social proof. If lots of other people are doing it, then you should too. And if you're not, what's wrong with you? Testimonials from people who are in a studio audience or may seem to be plucked randomly off the street serve a similar purpose.
I don't have to go to the store to buy a rotisserie chicken. I can make my own now and it comes out just scrumptious. I love it.
Social proof is often built right into the structure of an infomercial, where the pitchman works with a host who is ever so incredulous at first. Remy Stern.
She'll usually start off the infomercial with questions like, I can't really believe it does this, Jack.
You can make pasta with the Popeil automatic pasta maker in under 3 minutes.
From scratch?
No, no, no.
From scratch?
From scratch.
She's proxy for the people at home who are saying the same thing, which is, I can't believe it does that. Over the course of the infomercial, you'll watch that her tone changes and she'll finally sort of succumb to the pitch and realize that this is the greatest machine she has ever seen.
It really is an exciting pasta maker, isn't it? I mean, the Popeil automatic pasta maker is sensational. Now, there's the 1-800 number on your screen. I don't know what you're waiting for. It can't get any better than this.
Near the end of an infomercial, a pitchman will make one last effort to hook you by upping what's called the perceived value of the deal.
In addition to that, you get a package of semolina flour. You also get a pasta fork. You get a measuring cup. You get $100 worth of coupons, as well as a recipe booklet with English and Spanish instructions.
When and how to ask for the money, false scarcity, social proof, perceived value.
Everybody that calls in the next 30 minutes will also receive absolutely free my new sausage-making attachment with spices and casings included.
Ron Popeil has turned the art of the infomercial into a science. And if Ron Popeil has brought the half-hour form to its apotheosis, a company called Telebrands has done the same for the short form, spots that are no longer than a minute or two in length. Telebrands is headquartered in Fairfield, New Jersey. Displayed in the lobby of the building are honest-to-goodness trophies for products like the Better Pasta Pot and the World's Safest Can Opener. There's even a letter from a professor of mechanical design at Princeton University thanking Telebrands founder A.J. Kubani for a lecture he gave titled Finding Winning Products. That's what they do at Telebrands.
A lot of people see these commercials on TV and they say something like, well, you know, if that blanket with sleeves can sell, then anything will sell on TV.
Telebrands president and CEO, A.J. Kubani.
Well, it's really not that simple. It's actually quite challenging to come up with a winning TV product. Even for us, we've been in the business for 26 years, and we still fail 90% of the time.
One of the first products Kubani advertised on TV was a pair of sunglasses in 1987.
Introducing AmberVision, the most amazing breakthrough in vision technology since glasses were invented.
He figured out that he could build brand recognition by blanketing the airwaves with cheap, direct-to-consumer commercials, and then take the product into retail stores where he slapped an As Seen on TV logo on them, which he designed himself. It's a very lucrative formula, he told me, so that's what he's been doing ever since. But Kubani says he has a few key requirements for any idea before Telebrands will even consider developing it into a product.
They all solve a common problem.
Are there places in your home where you wish you had a light, but you don't?
The other thing is that they have to be innovative, or at least perceived as being innovative.
Oh no, that tired old style's been around for a while. But now there's Easy Combs, the easy new way to create dozens of dazzling new hairstyles instantly.
They have to be easy to manufacture en masse, which means that they're usually low-tech.
Fed up with spending hundreds of dollars on purses that just get soiled by dirty floors? Then you need Purse Hook.
Ramping up high-tech products can take a long time, and we don't have that kind of time.
That's because the life cycle for a product, from the time it hits the air to the time it leaves the stores, can be as short as a few months. But every now and then, Telebrands comes up with a big seller that may linger for a few years. These are the products that pay the salaries of the 40 or so employees and have made Kubani a wealthy man. Maybe you've heard of the Ped Egg. That's P-E-D-E-G-G, Kubani.
It's a product that removes calluses or dead skin from the bottoms of people's feet. It works the same way that a cheese grater does, except it's better blades, and it catches the shaved calluses so it doesn't make a mess.
Last year, more than 20 million people bought the Ped Egg. When I think back to the boardwalk of Atlantic City, as much as I can remember even the voices of some of the pitchmen out there, I can't remember if we ever bought anything. Turns out we did.
I bought knives, I bought choppers, I bought blender.
My mother, Belle of Wola.
They had the gadgets that made fancy vegetables, which I bought and could never do when I brought it home. They made it look so easy. You know, they sliced the tomato with one sweep. No, never happened.
My mother even has a few gadgets still tucked away in her closet. They're just waiting to transform her kitchen and change her life.
This is the Vidalia Chop Wizard that I was telling you about. It does not do an onion as good as they say. It's faster and easier by hand. I have a quick chopper, which I don't think I ever used. It's good for chopping, but you're a pretty good chopper. Oh, another one. This is a mixer jug. As you can see, I never used this one either. Some of the things I never used, brought it home and said, why did I buy it? And some things I did use.
Why did you buy it?
He was a good pitch man.
Ron Popeil likes to tell a story about his cousin, who sold a number of gadgets on the Atlantic City boardwalk in the 1950s. This cousin of his was such a good pitch man that one customer stood there and bought every item he had, only to walk away with two big shopping bags and toss the whole lot of it into a trash can not far away. Maybe that story's true, maybe it isn't. But it was in the 1950s that television took notice of the lowly pitchman for his ability to sell and lifted him up off the boardwalks and the street corners. Television, you could say, saved the pitchman. If TV ad rates keep slipping and traditional advertising becomes a thing of the past, maybe it'll be the pitchman's turn to save TV. For On the Media, I'm Mike Wolo.
I need a Vegematic. I need a pocket fisherman. I need a handy appliance that'll scramble an egg.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, TJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.